This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, a conversation with Jeff Strack, the man who has taken back the Strack and Van Til supermarkets and some of the other supermarkets that had been part of the Central Grocers chain, once a family chain, and now as the new CEO of Indiana Grocery Group, is taking the supermarkets into Northwest Indiana's premier chain into the future. We have a conversation with him coming up. Also a conversation with Indiana House Minority Leader and State Representative Scott Pelat. He's going to be a busy guy this weekend, as are many other Indiana Democrats who are headed to Southern Indiana for an annual meeting. We'll find out more about that. And also have a conversation continuing on with the dedication of the IU Northwest new Arts and Sciences building. It has been a very, very busy 2017 so far for Jeff Strack, the new chief executive of Indiana Grocery Group. The company going from taking action after Joliet-based Central Grocers announced it was filing for bankruptcy to taking back some of the supermarkets that was owned by the family and then moving into the future as Northwest Indiana's premier supermarket chain. I talked this morning with Jeff in his office in Highland. Jeff Strack, if you will, explain what Indiana Grocery Group is.
Well, it's a brand new company that came together here in the last couple months to participate in the bankruptcy auction involving the Strack and Van Til stores. And the ultimate outcome was that this new group of made up of the Strack and Van Til families, along with some other local business people, came together and were able to purchase 20 stores in Northwest Indiana that were made up of Strack and Van Til stores, 17 of them, and two Town and Countries, and an Ultra Foods location in Merrillville.
What kind of work, I guess, or maybe I should say, what were the thought processes that you and other people that have been connected with the Strack and Van Til and the Ultra supermarkets had after the word came out from Central Grocers that they couldn't keep it going? They had to file for bankruptcy.
You know, it had always been part of my desire over the years since Central Grocers purchased a majority stake in Strack and Van Til to one day be able to buy back our company. And when things were heading down the path and heading into bankruptcy, you know, that gave us the families an opportunity to see what possibility that we could put something together and put together a deal to buy the company back. And it was a long and interesting journey, and going through bankruptcy, it's you know, we've definitely learned a lot of things that they don't teach you in school about, and we were fortunate enough to come out as the winning bidder for these stores.
Now, we hear all the time about companies that have had to file for bankruptcy, and about briefly at least what has come out in news releases and elsewhere about the process. Obviously, you didn't have to learn much about bankruptcy other than what's it like to try to pick up a company that is filed for bankruptcy and bring it along and bring it to the point here. You mentioned about this interesting journey. Tell us what you had to do first. What did you and others involved in all of this process have to do at first once you learned that Central Grocers was going to have to go into bankruptcy?
I think the first step was to do a reality check and say, is this something that we really want to pursue? And like I said, all along, it was always a desire of mine to be able to buy the company back. And when this opportunity arose, then it was starting to think, okay, how do we go about doing that? There's many components, and bankruptcy is not there are no rules in bankruptcy, it seems, and it isn't a level playing field for the people that who are not the stalking horse. And in this case, Jewel was the stalking horse. But as you mentioned, the one thing that we knew the company's DNA, growing up in this business and knowing the stores, knowing the customers, knowing Northwest Indiana, we felt that these stores were still a viable and could be a successful ongoing business. So, you know, part of the first step was trying to see how we can put together a deal and come up with the financing. And as I mentioned, it's a brand new company, so there's a we had to go through and establish a new organization, come up with an operating agreement, and then we had to go in and find some other investors who wanted to participate. And that's not easily done today. I mean, when you're talking about brick and mortar retail, and then talking about the grocery sector, and then especially talking about a company that many on the outside see as is in bankruptcy, that's a tough sell to do. And we had a lot of conversations with people that were interested but just didn't feel comfortable getting into this space at this time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we were fortunate enough. There are people who know us personally, know the business, and know what Strack and Van Til was and currently is, and believe that this believed in the message that we were sending.
Jeff, when you deal with a company like supermarkets and the like here, and dealing with a company like Central Grocers, who was a primary, if I'm sure in many cases, in some certainly products, was your only supplier, and you have that company going away, what did you have to look for to be able to find somebody in the new company or that was going to supply everything that Central Grocers through the Centrella brand and other sources to was providing the supermarkets every single day? What did you have to look for to be able to take that job and carry it through into the new company?
Well, we didn't have very many options, and when Central started to go into their free-for-all, we quickly had to look for a temporary supplier. And again, being in bankruptcy and not knowing the future, there's not many options. And we were fortunate enough that SuperValu, one of the nation's largest wholesalers, agreed to take us on and on a temporary basis. And you know, it's been a little bit challenging from the fact that our groceries, started coming from multiple locations. The products that we were accustomed to buying from Central Grocers didn't match up exactly, and there was, which created a lot of missing variety in the store, and in some cases, some what we call holes or empty places in the shelves. Mm-hmm. So that was a little bit frustrating, but we were able to SuperValu work out a deal with them and be able to, most importantly, continue to have a supplier supplying our stores for our grocery and fresh food needs.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you, and related to that here, we know that obviously Central Grocers with the Centrella brand was very prominent. They had everything in one location over there in Joliet with, I guess, some other spots for handling some types of warehousing. When you have to rely on SuperValu did they kind of take over that role of offering it as the central warehouse that everything that their trucks would come to the Strack and Van Til stores and the Town and Country and the Ultra stores now that are open that are supplying the stores every single day? Or did you have to kind of make your own mini warehouse operation there in Highland?
No, we were able to. We had rented some space over the years across from in Munster, across from the Lansing Munster Airport. So yeah, we had some space there, and we did buy in on some Centrella label products. But for the most part, that part really didn't change in our operation. We had to work and scramble and with logistics and transportation needs from the various SuperValu warehouses. So it was there was a lot of work done by a lot of people on our team here at the office to make sure that we can continue to get supply. And it's being a temporary customer, you're not always first in the pecking list. So it was a little frustrating for our people, and I'm sure as it was for our customers, that sometimes we didn't know if we were getting our grocery load in on Tuesday morning or Wednesday morning, and sometimes that caused us to run a little short. But as we move forward, we'll be migrating to our permanent wholesaler, AWG, And we look for things to get back more to some normal operations here towards the end of the calendar year.
Tell us a little bit about AWG. People probably may be more familiar with SuperValu. They've heard about it or read about it. They may not have heard about or read about AWG. Tell us about this company.
Well, AWG, Associated Wholesale Grocers, is based out of Kansas City, and they're a cooperative, much like Central Grocers was.
Uh-huh.
They are probably, if you look at just from the wholesaling business, they're over a $10 billion a year company. And if you pull out the retail component of SuperValue, AWG is a larger company than them. They're probably in the top. They're the number one cooperative in the country, and they're probably, when it comes to wholesaling companies in general, they're definitely in the top probably three or four. So they definitely have a much larger scale and presence than what Central Grocers does, and that should be a benefit not only to us as a new business, but also to our customers, and as far as seeing, you know, better promotions, better deals, and possibly a wider selection of items in the store. And primarily when it comes to private label, while there was a Centrella brand, it was pretty limited in the number of items in the store. With AWG, there's actually four lines of private label. There's a low tier that goes up against Aldi type of products and will be priced at Aldi type of pricing, mm-hmm. called Always Save. And then the primary line, Best Choice, will be throughout the entire store. They have a natural and organic line, and they also have a premium food line. So all together, there's over 4,000 items that they have. So we're really excited about finally having a robust private label program in our stores.
Now, it sounds like that AWG is going to be basically taking over the role of being your supplier here at the end of this year, first of 2018, I understand?
Yeah, absolutely. It seems like it should go quicker than what it does, but you know, there's lead times with manufacturers. It's not like you need to give them some ramp up time. They need to get their facility in order and hire people and get product in the stores into the distribution center.
Yeah.
So there is a considerable amount of work and some lead time that goes into making a transition with the amount of business that we have for our 20 stores.
Well, it sounds interesting and sounds great for customers like me and family members who have shopped at Strack and Van Til stores for decades and even recent years, to see these great items being replaced on the shelves. We're going to miss some of the Centrella things, but we're not going to miss everything, and because it's going to be replaced with equally good and maybe even better product. That's great.
Absolutely.
To know,
if someone tries one of those items and they're not happy, we'll be happy to give their money back.
We're talking with Jeff Strack, who's the CEO of what is now Indiana Grocery Group, which has taken over many of the Strack and Van Til and related stores here in Northwest Indiana and kept them open, kept them going as well, too. What kind of response have you gotten as we speak here, going to the end of August, from customers who have seen the changes have to take place here? Are they happy with what the end result is being here, you folks taking over the stores and keeping them open and keeping the business going for all these people?
I think, you know, the response has been overwhelming, and it's been very extremely positive from obviously from our employees in the stores, but and our vendor partners and also the customers. And I think, you know, there's an emotional attachment to, you know, Strack and Van Til in Northwest Indiana, as there are to other organizations and businesses. You know, there's something different and special about Northwest Indiana that want to continue to have their businesses be local, and I think they appreciate that, and we still have to go out and earn our customers' business every day and provide them with a great shopping experience and provide them the value and the quality and the items they expect. So, you know, it's just not, you know, being local is real important, but we still have to perform and at the end of the day give them a relevant reason to come to our stores.
Well, I'm sure this has probably reduced a lot of the anxiety, certainly I'm sure among the employees at the stores, but also as well to, like you say, among the suppliers and the customers as well, to look forward to this here. I guess the question I have to ask you next, Jeff, is we know about, of course, the fate of the stores that Central Grocers had and the ones that have had to close, that some have closed already, some in the process of closing. We're looking mainly, I guess, at the ultra supermarkets that we're looking at here. Is there a possibility, in your opinion, right now as we speak, that Indiana Grocery Group might be able to take on some additional stores, like the ones in particular, some of the Ultra stores that in the process had gotten remodeled and upgraded over the last few years?
You know, anything's possible. Our immediate focus is going to be on our 20 stores that we purchased. We have some plans, and we want to get back into the stores and continue to work on the training and development of our people, really getting into making sure that our offerings for our consumers are right, and really try to raise the bar on the shopping experience for our customers. And, you know, we've been so busy in the last 9 months with all this noise going on with bankruptcy and so on that we haven't been able to, at the end of the day, be grocers. And we got to get back into there and make sure that, you know, that our stores are operating as efficiently and as possible, and that's where our immediate focus is. But down the road, you know, we're always looking for opportunities, as we have in the past. They have to make sense, and we'll probably be a little bit more cautious than what we were in the past. And but you know, if there's some of those locations are viable and projections look positive, then you know, we will consider them.
Well, Jeff Srack, we really appreciate you taking time from a very, very busy day. I know you have, although you probably had a chance to take a breather here, at least now after the, as you say, the initial noise of dealing with the Central Grocers bankruptcy and having to take on the prospects of a brand new business to bring a lot of the customers the services that they have asked for and gotten over the years and keep that service going and get a chance to, like you say, have a chance to look at the future as well, too. We thank you very much for taking some time to talk with us here, too. We'll let you get back to the business of keeping people happy and keeping their shelves stocked and their freezers and refrigerators filled with great food. Thank you for being with us to talk about it.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
A very busy weekend for Democrats in Indiana this coming weekend and of course, the months ahead as another election cycle gets underway. Let's check in not only with what's happening very soon, but in the near future with Indiana House Minority Leader, State Representative Scott Pilaf. He's a Democrat from Michigan City. And Scott, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Chris. Good to be back.
Well, tell us a little bit about the idea behind the Indiana Democratic Editorial Association weekend. You have a chance to get together in French Lick, Indiana, in southern Indiana, enjoy the weekend and the weather down there, as well as talk a lot of politics. Tell us about it.
By the way, that five-hour drive from Michigan City is also enjoyable, too.
Yeah, I know.
It's quite a trek, but when you get there, it is really worth it because French Lick's one of the most beautiful parts of Indiana. And it sort of keeps us in touch with the vastness of the Hoosier State. It's a good place for Democrats to convene, too. You know, particularly in a non-election year, there's always that physical importance of people being able to share their commonality of purpose, you know, take stock of things, share larger visions for the state. And that's always been the value of that event there. You really get a sense of how diverse the Democratic Party is in Indiana and how much future it has in front of it.
Do you find these opportunities like this when you have the annual get-together at French Lick tend to be a good way, as you say, for Democrats that don't necessarily see themselves at other times other than when the legislature is in session, or other people, that, for that matter, that are Democratic leaders across the Hoosier State, a chance to get together, talk things over, maybe a time for some seminars and some work sessions to be able to work out some things that you want to talk about in the future?
Well, it's like any other gathering of people. You've got a very committed group, and they're off in their individual communities, and they're working on the same things. They've got many of the same goals. They're talking to the same types of voters. They're expressing the same concerns about the direction of the state and the direction of the country. You know, even in the internet age, they're not always aware of each other's work. And when they can convene in one place, they're able to, you know, share with each other what's been effective, what hasn't been effective, but mostly to understand that they're part of something larger. And that's really what the value is of those types of events, whether they be conventions or more regional activities. We're all components of a much larger thing. And sometimes it means that being able to sort of sit across the table from someone or sit and have a chat gives you that boost of energy that you need to really continue the work that you're doing on a more local level.
Now, as far as the schedule for this year's annual meeting in French Lick is concerned, what types of topics are going to be brought up? What's going to come up at some of the work sessions and the seminars?
Well, it's hard to dismiss the elephant in the room, and that's what's going on in Washington, D.C.
Right.
And where Indiana fits into that. There are grave concerns, not just in Indiana, but throughout the nation about, what we've all jointly witnessed, in our nation's capital. And that gives context to all the other work we do. You know, we all have our philosophical visions of how we would, how we would like Indiana to look and what we think the best direction is. But there's an added sense of urgency too. The containment of some of the worst excesses of Washington has to be on everyone's mind, and I know it's going to be.
As well as the fact that you're concerned about what's happening in Washington at the White House, obviously you're concerned about Capitol Hill as well. Senator Joe Donnelly is going to run for another term of office. That's going, of course, in the next election cycle. But you start planning and campaigning right now. And do you think that there's going to be any talk amongst the other Indiana Democratic Party members about what kind of support needs to be put together to make sure that Joe Donnelly stays in office?
Well, the U.S. Senate race is extraordinarily important, not just for our state, but for our entire country. You know, if you're an average citizen and you're looking in the midterm election to make a mid-course correction for what transpired in 2016, Joe Donnelly is really your perfect choice.
Mm-hmm.
I say that almost without hesitation. When you have a practical leader who looks at every issue pragmatically with respect to, what's generally best for our state and what tough decision needs to be made to get the United States on, the right footing going forward, you want that sort of sober thinker. And he's really the perfect person to lead our ticket. I couldn't be prouder. He really exemplifies what it means to be an Indiana Democrat, but even more what it means to be, sort of a common sense Hoosier.
We're talking with Indiana House Minority Leader, State Representative Scott Tielath. He's a Democrat from Michigan City. And Scott, we have opportunities like this upcoming off your election to deal with issues, to talk about, as you mentioned, about the direction that should be taken. We're aware, of course, of the Senate race here. When we get back to Indiana, do we have any legislative races that are likely to come up for discussion in this next election cycle?
Oh, yeah. And there's going to be a myriad of them. And it's a little too early to zero in and say, well, this is the hot race in this community, or one up north is really going to take shape. That's not where the gamesmanship is right now.
Mm-hmm.
This is a point where people are looking at their state, looking at their country, and they're also looking within themselves and taking stock of whether they're really willing to serve in a very difficult environment. And I've been gratified up to this point that I think a lot of people are willing to take that step forward for no other reason. They want to be able to tell their kids and their grandkids what they were doing at this juncture in time, and were they willing to do things like stand up for the rule of law and our basic rights and the American system of which we're so deeply proud and committed to, and many people are going to be answering that call. And just for the sake of our republic and our democratic institutions, that's very exciting to see.
I'd be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about the upcoming General Assembly session. It's still a few months away, but January is not all that far away from where we stand right now. And we've gotten, of course, a new two-year state budget passed and in effect. What is likely to come up for discussion in the General Assembly session next year?
Well, there's two different aspects of that question. The
yeah.
First is what I think needs to come up, and that's the continuing lack of growth in our wages and economic purchasing power in this state. I mean, the evidence is that people are working. They're working harder than ever before, and their paychecks just aren't keeping up with changes in the rest of the economy. That has to be job one. That is the next frontier of economic development in this state is we need people with strong disposable income and the ability to continually adapt their skills to a changing national and world economy. That's job one, and that's where our focus needs to be. My fear is that it being an election year, it's going to degrade into some of those, you know, usual hot butt, hot button issues that get people stirred up for the election, and then a bunch of special interest based legislation. If it's those things, I think it's not going to be a success. If we're focused on really making people's lives better, both economically and with respect to their future opportunities, then I think we'll be on the right track.
So you think it is important here during this upcoming legislative session to be sure that the Holcomb administration, even though they have talked very seriously about improving Indiana's economy beyond where it is now, improving opportunities for jobs for people that need work, as well as people that need training for the jobs of the future in Indiana, if you just keep the Republicans on track, I suppose.
It's the right words and concept, but it's very difficult to execute. There's a great temptation just to, you know, focus on the interests and demands of a few and forget about the larger needs of the state. That's where the House and Senate minorities have very, very important roles, and that's to remind the majorities of why they're there.
We're talking with Indiana House Minority Leader Scott Pilat. He's a Democrat from Michigan City. And Scott, as always, thanks for taking time to talk with us today. Have fun this weekend at the Indiana Democratic Editorial Association get-together in French Lick, a beautiful place to be down there this time of year. And we hope to have a chance to chat with you here again as we get closer to the start of the upcoming session, as well as the start of the off-season elections as well, too, next year. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Chris. Always enjoy it.
This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We're continuing our look into this Friday's dedication ceremonies for IU Northwest's Arts and Sciences Building that is going to open up for students on Broadway in Gary. There is part of the Gary campus, but it's also going to be a very important part of the Ivy Tech Community College campus there in Gary in the neighborhood. And to talk about the impact that the new Arts and Sciences Building will have on Ivy Tech Community College, the faculty, staff, as well as the students who attend, we have Margaret Simmer, who is the Vice Chancellor of Academic Affairs for Ivy Tech Community College. Margaret, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
This has got to be a very exciting time for everybody at Ivy Tech Community College, as well as at IU Northwest, with this brand new building that's in place. Tell us about the importance that Ivy Tech Community College students' access to the arts has, because it has its own educational value for your students as well, right?
Well, right. We see the building, the Arts and Sciences Building, as a potential for collaboration unlike anything we've been able to see or experience before. You know, we've been limited with resources, so we don't have the ability to offer all kinds of curriculum in fine arts and sciences. So exposing our students in the same building is going to really create a synergy that unlike anything we've ever had available to us before. It's a game changer. We're really excited.
Have there been any other facilities, similar facilities, I'm sure, not necessarily designated to Ivy Tech, that have taken place at other Ivy Tech campuses with other universities or other similar types of institutions?
Sure. Well, down in Columbus, Indiana, there's a partnership building as well. And I believe that IU and Purdue are there with Ivy Tech. They are doing things a little bit differently than we plan to do things in Gary, but there have been these partnerships buildings before, and it's been demonstrated that there's success. It's good for students, it's good for the community, it's good for all of us.
They talk about mainly arts here, but I know, of course, there are sciences that will be available as well for students to take classes there in the building. When you talk about, even just from the arts standpoint, there's a lot of activities there. Students from Ivy Tech Community College are probably either certainly interested in it as a personal basis, but for an educational basis. How do you think the link is going to be from the courses and the opportunities out, maybe outside of class even, at IU Northwest will have for the Ivy Tech students?
Well, obviously the opportunities are going to be infinite. So, you know, just having students exposed to the different kinds of laboratories and facilities. I don't know if you've been over to the building yet, it's hard not to notice the energy and just the feel of it being a very sophisticated space for arts and sciences. So, you know, I see that there's just going to be a lot of integrating between Ivy Tech students and IU students. We're going to be working towards developing agreements where students flow, you know, seamlessly from their Ivy Tech education to the IU bachelor's degree. And that's going to provide just all kinds of opportunities for students as they participate and as they have, this really fulfilling educational experience in the building.
Now,
go ahead.
I was going to say that it's very important that people know that this facility is this partnership between IU Northwest and Ivy Tech Community College, and the opportunities for students to learn in state-of-the-art facilities has got to be very, very exciting for students, especially if they're young people who are already experienced a lot of the technology at home or in other places.
Right. Well, you know, and again, going to not really, you know, our limited resources and not being able to update things is to the degree we would have liked in the past, just, you know, I'm going to brag about the science labs, okay? So, you know, what we keep hearing is that we probably right now, Ivy Tech has the most state-of-the-art science labs in the region. And that is so exciting for our students, just to see the energy of the students and the faculty. Oh, they're so excited about teaching there. It's just an amazing step for us at Ivy Tech to really have this facility at our, you know, at our fingertips, and for the students to have that opportunity to really, you know, really understand. And we do know that some of our high school students that come to Ivy Tech, they have great high schools in Northwest Indiana, and they've had some exposure to some really state-of-the-art technology. And so, you know, we need to keep pace with that. We need to be right there where the technology is and where it's going. And we're doing that here in the Arts and Sciences building.
We're talking with Margaret Semmer, who is the Vice Chancellor of Academic Affairs for Ivy Tech Community College in Gary. And Ivy Tech Community College, of course, is one of the beneficiaries of the new IU Northwest Arts and Sciences building that is opening up for classes this fall. The dedication ceremony is actually going to be on Friday there at the facility on the Gary campus of IU Northwest. And we've talked about the exciting opportunities that students are going to have in this new building with state-of-the-art labs, the science labs, and the like. I'm thinking, too, this has to be a big benefit not only for students of Ivy Tech Community College who would want to follow through and become students at IU Northwest to benefit their education and their career opportunities, but how about adult students? They certainly are coming into Ivy Tech to pick up some new skills, to learn the new workplaces of the future in Northwest Indiana. This has got to help them out, too.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because at Ivy Tech, a large percentage of our students are returning adult students. Everybody will think, not everybody, but, you know, we have a sort of an image that we're for high school students that aren't going away to the four-year universities. But at the same time, we have this huge population of adult learners that we're hoping to touch and capture and bring them into the fold and have them experience all of these new technologies and you know, obviously retrain, obviously, you know, improve their skills, you know, do something different. I mean, that's a part of life now. We don't stay in one career for a lifetime anymore. We change. We need to grow. We need new skills. And we're really excited about that opportunity for our adult students.
Now, you had the opportunity to see the building go up, starting from just an old parking lot, or actually in just space there on the corner there at, I think, 34, 35th and Broadway.
35th.
And it's now become this beautiful three-story building. What kind of experiences or maybe I hate to say training, but at least preparation have you and your colleagues there at Ivy Tech Community College had as this building is taking shape and now had a chance to open up? I'm sure you've had to go through some orientation to get familiar with the new building as well.
Well, you know, right. I mean, so, you know, we're learning quickly about the building and we're experiencing it as it's opened. You know, we really needed to understand how we were going to flow with the students from another building and how we're going to work with our colleagues at IUN. And so far that's just gone so well. People are really mingling. You know, my hope, for the faculty. We have all the faculty together on the second floor. It's really a unique space where the IU faculty and the Ivy Tech faculty are sharing a big space just for faculty. And our hope is that they mingle and they get to know each other and they share experiences and that it becomes more of a collaborative team and that we can learn from each other. So that's one of the things we're experiencing right now that's kind of exciting. And just, you know, the basic issues you have with the new building. Do we have the right sign where it needs to be? And are students finding the classrooms? Well, we have a team, a large team of folks there helping and directing students. So it's going very well. I've been on this project for almost 6 years. So it's really exciting to see it all come together.
I'm sure there'll be the growing pains. Students get lost in new buildings as well as faculty members, it sounds like, too. And you've got at least two common things that you and the folks at IU Northwest will have the same problems, too. You'll have to figure out how things work and rooms are in the building and all. So it's going to be a growing experience and learning experience for everybody, too, it sounds like. But a very exciting one as Ivy Tech Community College can go into the next phase of classes and operations in the future. Margaret Sammer, who's the Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs at Ivy Tech Community College, which is joining with IU Northwest in this new Arts and Sciences building that's gone up on the Gary campus. Thank you very much for talking with us about this, and the best of luck to all of you and your colleagues at Ivy Tech Community College as the campus continues to grow and continue the programs that will help Northwest Indiana residents learn as well as prosper in the future. Thank you for talking about it today.
Thank you so much. As I mentioned before, it's a game changer, and we're really excited. Thank you for having me on.
I can tell it's in your voice, and we appreciate you sharing that with us. Thank you. This Friday evening, a museum that is tucked into the lower level of the former Indiana Bell Exchange office in downtown Miller Beach, which is now home to the Regional Indiana Landmarks Office, will feature an American writer who writes about another well-known author who wrote his books in Chicago and in Miller. Nelson Algren wrote, among other works, The Man with the Golden Arm, which of course became a very hit film vehicle for Frank Sinatra. Douglas Cowie is visiting the Nelson Algren Museum on Friday night to talk about him. And I had a chance to talk with Douglas about his upcoming visit to the museum and what intrigued him so much about Nelson Algren and his kindred spirit and lover, Simone de Beauvoir. Douglas, if you will, tell us a little bit about yourself and about your interest in the author Nelson Algren and how he's gotten involved with Northwest Indiana.
I'm originally from the Chicago area. I grew up in the western suburbs, but I've been living in mostly in the United Kingdom now since 1999. And I started getting interested in Nelson Algren about 15 years ago or so. He's a name that I, being a kind of a literary nerd growing up in Chicago, I always knew his name, and I knew some of the titles of his books, The Man with the Golden Arm or Chicago City on the Make. These are things that come up if you're paying attention to literary stuff in Chicago pretty regularly, but I'd never actually read anything by him until after I finished my PhD, and it occurred to me that if I considered myself, I was writing a novel at that time, and I thought if I considered myself a novelist, and I considered myself a novelist from the Chicago area, maybe I should read Nelson Algren. And I was just, my mind was blown when I read Never Come Morning. And so then I ended up reading all the rest of his stuff, and then I realized after reading all this fiction that I really just loved for a million different reasons. It occurred to me I didn't really know anything about him, except that his name was Nelson Algren and he was from Chicago. Mm-hmm. So I thought, oh, I wonder if there's a biography about him, and there is. There's now two, actually. But at that time there was one biography by Bettina Drew, and I read that and discovered a number of interesting things about him and started really doing a lot more research into his work and into his life. To make a very, very long story much shorter, all of this led me to writing a novel about Algren and his relationship with Simone de Beauvoir, the French philosopher and writer, which seemed to me a very interesting and very hard to pin down center point of his life, one of the center points of his life, if a life can have more than one center point. And that relationship also then really puts a focus, this is where Indiana comes in, it really puts a focus on Indiana, because Algren lived in most of his life, he lived in Chicago and in Miller, Indiana. He lived there in the mid-1950s in a small house right down by the lake. that house he first rented because Simone de Beauvoir was coming to visit him, and they wanted to get out of Chicago in the middle of the summer, and he knew some people who already lived there, and they helped him find a house, and he ended up basically going there partly to give her a place to be with him, partly to give themselves a place to be alone. He ended up writing Chicago City on the Make there, which is probably the greatest poem ever written about a city. It's a long prose poem about Chicago, and it's, I mean, I reread it every couple of years, and it's always really an exciting thing to read. But they went back there a few times over the years, and he lived there himself year-round for a while. And it's interesting. I was thinking about this yesterday. Thinking of the question of, like, how important is Algren to Northwest Indiana? Mm-hmm. And I kind of decided that I don't think Algren is actually that important to Northwest Indiana, but I think he's important to Chicago. He wrote about Chicago a lot. He wrote about some other places too, but mostly about Chicago.
Yeah, I understand he did a lot of his writing there at his apartment in Chicago, which was there, I guess, in what was at the time the old Polish neighborhood there in Ashland Avenue.
Yeah, in Wicker Park. And this is a great metaphor for Algren's life and reputation, that where his apartment was is now where the expressway runs right through. You know, they knocked it down to make the expressway. He's always kind of being obliterated in the name of progress somehow.
It's probably just as well that he's passed on and he doesn't know that. He probably might be very disappointed.
Yeah.
Or then again, too, he may very very much delight it, like you say, because of that.
I think he might have seen the irony in it. What interested me, though, about Northwest Indiana is that whereas Algren might not be so important to the place, other than the fact that he's an interesting person who was on that, you know, land, I think the place is actually really important to him in a way that people don't necessarily obviously think about. Because it's very easy when you see a writer who writes about Chicago to say, oh, Chicago was an important place to him. And it's kind of it's a slam dunk thing to say. Whereas Indiana, this is a place where he spent some really important years with a really important person in Beauvoir. And he also wrote, he wrote one of his great pieces of work there, one of the great pieces of literature about Chicago. He wrote in that little cabin down on the lagoon with Lake Michigan on the other side. And, you know, when you go down there, it's really easy to see why that's a great place to be a writer. It's very quiet. It's very isolated. You can go and walk. You can go and row around on the lagoon, which he did a lot. You can go over the dune and look at Lake Michigan and see Chicago in the distance. And there's something really, I mean, for me anyway, there's something really inspiring and something really, you feel your sense of place there. And you can imagine someone sitting there thinking about what he's writing about, thinking about Chicago, thinking about the various literary and social interests he had, but in this quiet, calm, seemingly isolated place that's still absolutely connected to this big city that he's so concerned with. And it seems to me that there's just a huge importance of this place to Algren's life and to Algren's work. I think it's really interesting to go to Miller and to think about that, and it makes it great that museum is there as well.
Now, you mentioned the fact that Nelson wrote Chicago, A City on the Make, there while he was spending his time there in Miller. Did he do any other works or start on any other works coming back from Chicago to visit the place in Miller?
Yeah, well, he did, actually. This is not a completed work. He spent a lot of time in Miller also working on a novel that he never completed, which was parts of which were published, I guess, I'm trying to think, maybe 10 years ago, maybe a little less than 10 years ago, mm-hmm. as Entrapment and Other Writings. This was a novel that he tried to work and really never really got going. And he basically rewrote the same few scenes over and over and over again and got frustrated and couldn't really make it work. Because his time in Miller also coincides, which I'm not blaming Miller for, with a real downturn in his literary fortunes and from my point of view anyway, a corresponding downfall in his mental health. And he really went through some of his toughest times there. And his probably least, he goes from through his most productive period of life in the mid to late 40s into the early 50s, and then almost immediately on the back of that goes through his least productive period of of literary life for the next, you know, 10 or so years, if not more.
Well, it sounds like that a lot of his problems were not only writer's block related, perhaps, just couldn't get his thoughts together on a particular way to approach this. Like you say, he worked over this piece, the scene several times, but it may also be maybe the time that he started to physically start to have problems.
Yeah, well, and politically had problems as well.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the ways I think about my thinking about him for the last several years, because I was working on this novel, was really so focused on the relationship with Beauvoir, where she's over in France and he's in Chicago, and they meet for long periods of time, then have these long periods of time where they're not together. And so my thinking on this is a little bit skewed by senses of place, because it's almost, and the way I constructed my novel was as a novel of places, where there's places where they're together and there's places where they're apart and so on. And, you know, he ran into, because of he's politically very much on the left, he ran into a lot of problems. He couldn't get a passport. The FBI was surveilling him, also surveilling him in Miller, talking to his neighbors in Miller, reading his mail that was coming to him in Miller.
And he's probably the issues that the HUAC is known for, certainly with other writers and actors and the like, being accused of their leftist leanings and being members of the Communist Party and all
mm-hmm.
that. You know, so.
Yeah, absolutely. He was absolutely on the same lists.
quite literally, so it sounds like.
It took him years to get a temporary passport so that he could travel to Paris to see Beauvoir. Oh. And his FBI file is kind of an interesting read, because it's a waste of everybody's time. He's not doing anything subversive, you know, signing the odd petition, giving the odd speech. He was nominally the head of an organization campaigning on behalf of the Rosenbergs. But, you know, he's not actually doing much of anything other than trying to write and live his life. And you see this again and again, and when you can go through the FBI file, and just there's nothing to report there. The interesting thing is, actually, he had Simone de Beauvoir's name on his mailbox in Miller, because she was also receiving work to do and things through the post there, and receiving mail from friends in France at that address. And so somewhere in his FBI file, an agent notes that he might be using the alias Simon de Beauvoir.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Right.
No connection with the fact that maybe that she might actually be a person, a live person, and actually spending time with him there in of all places, Miller Beach, Indiana, to be sure.
Yeah.
Now, have you had a chance, by the way, Douglas, to actually visit the Nelson Algren Museum there in the lower level of the Indiana Landmarks building in downtown Miller?
I have indeed, yeah. It's one of the most exciting things I've ever done. I got to sit in his chair and everything.
That would be interesting, yeah. You get, because they have, if you've ever visited the museum, or you have a chance to visit here when the presentation's coming up here on August 25th, it's a very small facility, to be sure, but it's very well laid out, and part of the layout is a little, I hesitate to call it a diorama, but it's probably the best description, because basically it's a desk with a typewriter
mm-hmm.
and an interesting backdrop, which basically is pictures, actual pictures, or an enlargement of pictures of a view out of his apartment window in Chicago. So you actually you can sit in that chair, and I'm sure for you it was probably very exciting to sit in front of the typewriter that he actually used to write us many of his works, and look out that window, although you're looking at a picture, but kind of visualize what it would be like to be sitting in that chair in that Chicago apartment and looking out there. And there are other pictures too, by the way, in the display that show the neighborhood that we've talked about, which is now part of the expressway there in the Wicker Park neighborhood in Chicago, where he used to live there on Ashland Avenue in that vicinity there. You know, it's all gone, of course, but the idea is that you see pictures where he actually stayed at the time back in the 40s and 50s. It's amazing. It sounds like that you have a great time to tell of your experiences and what you've learned in your research about Nelson Algren when you come into Miller for the presentation on Friday the 25th. And Douglas Cowie, I really appreciate you taking time to talk with us about this, and we hope you you do enjoy your stay, and the crowd that comes to visit the museum and listen to your speech enjoy it as well, as much as I've enjoyed having a chance to listen to you talk today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks very much.
This is Douglas Cowie, who is the author of a book entitled Noon in Paris, Eight in Chicago. And he will speak Friday night at 7 o'clock at the Nelson Algren Museum, which is in the lower level of the Indiana Landmarks Building on South Lake Street in downtown Miller. And by the way, a new artist, Frank Zerbo, will also be on hand that evening for a presentation at the opening of an exhibit on his works entitled Algren-esque, Characters from the Neon Wilderness. And Frank's portrait work is already on display there at the museum. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow, it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. We'll have reporters from the local media taking a look at the major stories of Northwest Indiana through the week. We hope that you'll join us for that.